session number 30304.
Ted Rayner, Reel 9. Ted, can you tell me about the navigation training that you did while you were flying the Ansons?
Yes. Navigation was taught to us, we were taught by a very good chap who made clear the purpose of the course and speed calculator, really similar to a slide rule, onto which we could put the three vectors which were important in dead reckoning navigation. Dead reckoning is, of course, substituted in many cases by the initials DR, and a lot of people don't seem to realise what is meant by that. And they certainly wonder what dead reckoning means. It is actually the word D-E-A-D, dead, although that's the way it's written, although it is, in fact, short for deduced reckoning. And the three vectors, of course, are the course, well, let's start with the most important one, the track that you want to make from A to B, the course that you will have to fly in order to do that, and the course is referring to the compass, magnetic or otherwise, and the wind is shown as a vector from the base of the track vector. So let us say that if we have a distance of 500 miles to cover and the wind speed is 50 miles an hour, we probably find that we would have to make an allowance of about 10 degrees flying into wind, so that the movement of the air whilst we were flying from A to B would in fact take us along the track and not along the course that we plotted on the map. That took quite a bit of explaining, although we'd done the basics in elementary flying training. But once that is understood, really the rest of it is relatively simple. Sometimes there seems to be, amongst the people who would like to know and don't, somehow there's a misunderstanding between the words track and course. They say I'm flying such and such a course. They don't really realise that it's a track that you're flying when you're allowed for the wind. If there was no wind, then going from A to B, that's the track over the ground that you have to cover, the track would be the same as the course, because there's no wind, or the wind could, of course, be coming directly along that particular vector or line, or behind you. If it was behind you, you were flying the 500 miles, and the wind was behind you at 50 miles an hour. So I say 50 knots, remember we're in coastal Guam, 50 knots behind you, you would obviously cover that 500 miles much more quickly than you would if the wind was against you at 50 knots. And I leave you to work that out. It's quite easy if you just draw a line and grade it according to some code. Yes, so when, I don't know if there's anything further to mention, I can't remember anything more important than that about navigation. It is obvious that there is a need to consider altitude and pressure, which of course are related, and to be aware of the methods of getting an estimate of the wind at the particular height and place at which you're flying, and there are various means of doing that. There is a Beaufort code, long been in existence, which relates typical visual sightings, such as the direction in which smoke is travelling, if you can see where it's starting from, which is one way of estimating the wind at whatever height. In that case, if you are using smoke, you have to remember that smoke is only seen relatively lower levels, and what you may see at a height of 2,000 feet, and very seldom do you see smoke higher than that, then if you're up at 8,000 feet, you have to think very carefully about whether you should use that as an indication or not. Other things such, and particularly of course for sea estimates, the code, the Beaufort code, normally carried on any patrol, gives you an approximate wind speed by what is known as the wind vane, the wind. It's known as the wind. The word escapes me. But there are lines of ripples or waves which are from the air appear to be parallel and give you an indication of the direction from which the wind is coming. If you can imagine a line at right angles to the line of the waves, and of course the way that the waves are breaking, and at speeds of above 10 knots, 10-15 knots, it's a fairly accurate way of getting the wind speed, again of course at ground level. So that has to be taken into account. I can't think of any other important factor in navigation. If you knew how to handle those signs, then you would be able to navigate from A to B pretty satisfactorily.
In a navigation flight, would you be as well, obviously you'd put all these factors into place before you flew, but would you, all that time, would you then be using visual, if you could, visual sights on the ground to help with
the
navigation?
Yes, in the way I've described, so far as smoke is concerned. Other things are really very peripheral, but quite important in certain instances, and particularly if you're at a low altitude, such as the way in a storm or a high wind, trees are bending, that kind of thing. But it's always a good idea to have some indication of atmospheric pressure so that you can build that into the figures that you're working to. And really the only satisfactory way to get an indication of atmospheric pressure is to go down to sea level, if you're over the ocean, and set the altimeter to zero, or a preferred setting, depending on the reason for the need for it, or to get ground pressure either along the route or at the terminal airfield where you're intending to land, and adjust your altitude to that pressure.
If you were making a navigational training flight, what form would it take? Would you fly to a specific place, or would you have to fly a specific route, or would you do a triangular route to come back, or something
like
that?
Yes, well, of course, many of the exercises were designated. Perhaps we would have to fly to an outstanding landmark, even as specific as the plinth. Let's think of a long, a high, form of building. Forget about that, and let's take a church instead, because I couldn't think of the word. You would perhaps be told to fly on a track from the base to this church, then on to another track to take you to another landmark, similar, a bridge perhaps, or a railway line station, at a certain altitude, and so on. Much of the flying detail would be of that kind in navigation training. Although, of course, we flew in pairs, and one would be flying the aircraft, and the second pilot, it may be his navigation exercise, and he will be doing the navigating and passing the instructions to the pilot. And then, of course, the pilot would be responsible to maintain the airspeed which the navigation required, the compass heading to get to the next point, so that that will be the navigation training for the second pilot in this case. And on the next training session, the positions would be reversed, and the pilot who had been doing the navigating would be the pilot of the aircraft, and the pilot who had been doing the piloting would be doing his navigation.
At this time, did you do any bombing practice at all?
Oh, yes. The bombing practice at SFTS was by means of the camera obscura. This is a building not unlike the Kentish Hop.
Oast houses.
Oast, yes. Kentish Oast, and there's a hole in the top, keep it as simple as possible, and the aircraft doing the bombing practice would be told what kind of bombing run to make, whether it would be a straightforward line fall or a straddle, and the aircraft was equipped with a very bright spotlight representing the bombs. If there were, say, you were supposed to be using four bombs, then there would be four flashes from the aircraft as it flew on the course needed to reach the camera obscura. And the course and steering calculator was also a bomb sight, which had wires on it and graded according to the height and the distance between the bomb drops. And you had to fly so that you approached the camera obscura, and then the person who was navigating would take on the job of bomb aimer, because of course he had to do both in the early days of the war anyway, and get the target, camera obscura again, the target coming down the bomb site wires, and just wires which were parallel to it, and which you had to keep the target coming down between the wires, shouting instructions to the pilot to make very fine corrections to actually get over the target. Not quite over the target. I'll explain that in a minute. To find the point in relation, that's much better, find the point in relation to the target when the bomb switch had to be pressed. I made that correction because, of course, if you drop a bomb directly over a target from a moving aircraft, it's not going to hit the target by virtue of the fact that the bomb is moving with the aircraft at the moment that it's dropped. So it always has a forward speed, and then its own weight takes over. And of course, the clever Boffin people work out the kind of arc that you can expect the bomb to take in order to reach the target from various heights. So that has to be fed into the bomb sight, so that as you approach the target and it reaches the point where you know you've preset the point where the bomb should be dropped, you hope, as a navigator or a bomb aimer in this case, that the pilot is carrying out your instructions very carefully. It may be a case of left, left a little, or right, right, steady, steady, coming down the wire, coming down, left a little, left, hold her, and that kind of thing until it's now, and the bomb is pressed. The flash, which represents the bomb, again, all this has to be calibrated because the flash doesn't travel, of course. But on the inside the camera obscura, there is a chart table on which is marked the target. And the flash is recorded through the aperture up in the top of the building, this small, small building like an house. And you found you were very lucky, actually, if it had actually hit the target. But that was the way it was done.
Did you do an altitude test as well while you were there?
Yes. Yes, that's part of, I think, well, I mean, I'm certain, must be every pilot's test includes being able to go up to 15,000 feet without oxygen. So you just, it's a very leisurely sort of test, because all you do is just sort of climb up round and round and round, and then you have a lovely view of the countryside on a fine day. Up to 15,000 feet. I did notice a slight difference in breathing, but there was nothing that was noticeably troublesome. Very little reaction. So then you say, yes, I've done it, and down you go. And that was it.
What heights would you normally start to use oxygen at? What's the usual height you would suggest?
I've never used oxygen, actually, so I can't really answer that from actual experience. The only time I've flown at a height of more than 7,000 or 8,000 feet, and that would only be in case of high... I was going to say that would only be in case, in Europe anyway, unless you're over the Alps, just to be sure that you are out of the way of any high land. But the only occasion that... Well, there were two occasions now, I've come to think of it. One was on the Thousand Bomber Bremen raid, when we had to, when I say we, I mean the 100 or so Hudson aircraft crews who were included in the bombing raid that night. We had to fly at 12,000 feet. I can't say that I noticed any effect on me at the time, but of course we had other things to think about. That was because the heavy stuff, the four engine bombers, which in 1942 were just then coming into more general use, would be up above at 16,000 feet. And we were only given 20 minutes to get to the target, because that was just a lull in the heavy stuff dropping their bombs. And if you didn't get in at that time, then it's best to stay out, because you were likely to find a bomb might be dropping on you. The other occasion was flying over the Iceland, the Greenland ice cap, which goes up to 11,000 feet. And so obviously we had to fly a little higher than that in order to get over the top of it.
During this stage, I assume you were also still receiving ground instruction.
Oh, yes, yes. That would be every other day. Yes, it would be until we got our wings. I think I mentioned that at Little Brittington we had Kidlington as a satellite, and we had to travel there every other day for flying tuition up to wings standard. Then after the award of wings, we worked from Little Rissington itself, and I don't think we had as much ground lectures and that kind of thing then as we had in the pre-wings period.
At that point, once you receive your wings, the training then obviously change more towards getting as much flying time in as possible in the training?
Yes, and also it becomes more realistic. in the sense that, for instance, one of the tasks we had to carry out would be a detailed reconnaissance at a low level, assuming that there was enemy opposition, and my flying partner and I had to go to the station at Didcot, and whilst taking imaginary evasive action, carry out a detailed record of the rolling stock that was within the area, passing through or in the yards, and what kind of ground activity there was, whether this would be perhaps if it was supposedly an enemy place, whether they'd be unloading material for some future military use, or whether it was just civilian stuff, that kind of detail. And the reports, of course, were checked, and it did become very much more realistic then. And similarly with the low-level bombing, again over the... because, of course, Little Islington is some distance from the sea, again over the camera obscura, more emphasis on landing problems, such as precaution, more time spent on precautionary landings and approaches, and that kind of thing.
You mentioned taking evasive action while you were doing the reconnaissance mission over Didcot. What form of action would that take? What would you be doing to...
Well, basically, of course, evasive action is varying the position of the aircraft as much as possible, bearing in mind that you have a target to awaiting your attention. And the likelihood of more opposition rather than less if you hang around. So really you just simply vary the attitude of the aircraft, the track you're on, or the course you're steering, whichever you prefer. Let's just emphasize those again, the track you're on, or the course you're steering, not necessarily the same thing. Over the ground, I mean. Not presenting, put it the other way, presenting as little of the aircraft to any imaginary, in this case, gun emplacement, ACAC fire, even observer noticing, that sort of, and variations in height as well, remembering that you have a preferred height, or indeed a determined height at which you have to make your final approach, or one of your approaches, to the target.